Barbara 7. This is the beginning of a new reel, Barbara 7. This is the beginning of a new reel, Barbara 7, Channel 1 Right. Channel 1 Right. Channel 1 Right, and a continuation of the talk after supper while we're waiting for the Poolside Saga at 9 o'clock on Sunday night, the 30th of November, 69. Sunday night, the 30th of November, 69. This is a continuation of that talk from the other reel, Barbara 6. And this is Channel 1 Right.
Reminded me an awful lot of my brother's reporting. The way my brother tells the tale. He was talking about Jim. Something about the tone of voice and this fella.
Yeah.
And this fella keeps his stables in a, you know, kept him in a that's what it is, the way he could say, you know, so to say the way he suggested things. And keep that real quiet. But had his, you know, when he's talking about how Jim had his horse in a barn, in the back of the barn.
Yeah.
And spend all this time on the back of the barn and what it was like. And then sort of say, I told him to get him out of there quick. And that's all you see of him. In telling. Taking a while to get around to filling in. I think a little bit better at getting things the first time through. Stopping and looking things the first time. The thing that impressed me about it, that I liked about it, is the sort of, that good humor when he was talking about Jim and that horse. And you never really saw the horse.
No.
But you got a feeling that he was rather amused an animal.
Yeah.
And, you didn't really need to see him. His character started to sit out. That's great. That and the truck going down the mountain. I can see that. I can really see that. Tumble down truck and go around those curves. Not, I imagine he was just standing there going from side to side. I followed some trucks down the mountain that had horses in them. And yeah, just loose. Those farmers stick a horse in the truck, pickup truck, and the poor horse, any horse of any size gets into a truck like that, it usually has to stand catacornered anyway. And they shift. And they can't stand up. And they go around the curve, and the horse goes over to one side. And
leans against the rail.
They can get in a good scramble sometimes, but they lose their footing.
Oh, yeah.
And they're there in the middle of the truck bed, scrambling around. And I imagine they can lean pretty heavy on it. Make a lot of difference. Especially, I don't know what size, sort of truck he had, besides the fact that he was pretty shambling. Yeah.
Exactly.
He was all right treacherous in the truck. I don't like shit in that way. Heck, we used to, like I said, with Verdi, we had a 9-horse truck. You put them in there crossways, nose to tail. And And sometimes those horses would lose their footing, and they'd trample on the horse next to them, and they'd slip down. If they were little, especially, it was bad. They could fall and slip underneath another horse, and that would panic that horse, and you'd have a real fracas in the back. And if you're in the middle of a curve and something like that happens, that's a lot of weight shifting around back there. And even those big trucks are a little bit top heavy.
Yeah.
One of those, I imagine, was how they felt in that.
Oh, they are.
They had some hay. I didn't see how it was.
Did you see how much it was?
Yeah, but it gave him a way to get into it. The way he was, I don't know whether he was looking at it that way when he started or not. When he started, it was right gleeful.
Yeah.
It was.
It was right gleeful. And then the more he got into it, and the more he started talking about seeing those barns again, the more dismal it got. Now, when he started, I don't think he was thinking about that at all. He was just thinking about Jim and how he met him and the sort of people he'd met and he wanted to talk about and the little shows. And it wasn't until he started looking closer that he began to get that one line on it.
Yeah.
I don't think he meant it that way.
No.
Well, he picked it up. He still, I think he was still having trouble. I don't think he came in with that bit about the gym and the mountain and riding that horse and that show. He'd already thought, he'd been thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
But when he started on the people at the shows, he was having to work through that while he was talking.
Yeah.
Think
you're
on
right.
His feet.
Yeah.
And he was having trouble.
He didn't get much into that.
He didn't really get into it. I mean, he didn't have anything he could draw on to just say, you know, like that race with him coming off the saddle or anything. Except the one thing where he was talking about swapping horses with his chap and missed his ride.
Yeah, he pulled that out.
He pulled that out. But and if he'd been thinking about it, he probably could have pulled out a bit more if he'd had a little time to shift around in it. I think probably if he were to come back tomorrow and somebody would lead into that without him knowing it, he'd come up with a bit more. Because he would have, you think about things like that without knowing you're,
yeah.
Without doing it on purpose.
It's got a lot in your mind.
Yeah. You start, little things start occurring to you. You see things a little bit different light. It's a long evening.
Wonderful. But knowing Nick as we do, I was pleased to see him switch. She had a great deal of flexibility compared to what we've known.
This is Blank the Tape from 94 to 98. This is Blank the Tape from 94 to 98. This is Blank the Tape from 94 to 98. This is Blank the Tape from 94 to 98. This is Blank the Tape from 94 to 98. This is Blank the Tape from 94 to 98.
When he got in the car ready to leave, we said, now don't make 100 miles an hour. Lynn said, it's got too much power. And he went around the corner and said, power like Molly.
Yeah.
I went through the whole tape with him. He'd say over there at those shows, jeez, if I just had had Molly. Deep voice today. Nobody rides my horse but me. Yeah.
That's one of those tones.
Yeah. Before we get into here, on the way to the store, when I rode over with him, I said, "Nick, the most surprising thing I've found out is that Molly's just horse size." He said, "I know it, but that's my size." I said, "Well, I thought she was a big horse, Nick." "Oh, you didn't. She's just 14, too. Just right for me."
Side of him or the other, get two different weights. The light's different, strong light. Sometimes you go out there and he looks so good.
Uh-huh.
Another time you go out and he looks like a rack of bones.
Uh-huh.
But everybody that's come up here says he's fatter.
Well, he's not weighing as much now as he did when you came.
You don't think so?
Well, I don't know, but this summer, before you came, he was, you couldn't believe it.
On the grass?
Mm-hmm. On this rich grass. For the
yeah.
first time, he really looked almost like
a horse.
We had the best grass this summer, ever.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the Shropshire land a little bit.
I already talked about it.
I hadn't heard you, though.
I wrote it out.
Of it is, I wish one could know them. I wish there were tokens to tell the fortunate fellows that now you can never discern. And then one could talk with them friendly and wish them farewell and watch them depart on the way they will never return. That reminded me so much of Whitman.
That's right.
That, touch. I don't know. Know them.
Uh-huh.
Know them in the right terms.
Yeah. Talk with them friendly and wish them well. Yeah, to know them
different. I know in Cookie well enough to see him.
Yeah.
And think of all those that we have passed by.
Uh-huh.
Is it easy enough to know people at your own level? You know almost what they're going to do and say and think?
Well, it's easier than trying to know somebody like Cookie. A bit more predictable. You can think in the same terms they do.
Barbara, I think there's more to Judy than you will admit. Your reporting on her is better than it is on Celia or Mr. Tilk or Jean. And I wasn't impressed with your reporting on Trudy. That impresses me, your reporting on Judy.
Well, there's a clash with Judy. There's not a clash with any of the others.
Yeah, that's it.
I haven't tried. I could probably report on Elaine the same way. Though it's more difficult. Because like I said, Judy, I can see a fight is a good fight. And feel that nothing's wrong. Whereas Elaine, I don't. Don't feel.
Well, now, what
fair.
Was Judy's feeling about the money?
Well, she was, she wasn't going to let a penny get by that didn't come into that stable. She would, she had a great go at Jane because Jane never could remember the prices. And she had her memorize them, and then every few hours she would come up to her and say, "Now quote the prices to me." So to make sure she got them straight. And she was absolutely horrified if anybody undercharged somebody for something. But then she'd look at the, every time that there was a horse there to be trained, for training, especially the little ponies who were so bratty, because the ponies that came in from outside were horrible little things. They'd been had some little child on them that couldn't make them do, and they would really get in bad habits and be horrible little beasts and spend their time wrecking our equipment and so forth. And that would send Judy into a fit. She would go up and down saying, I don't see, all the other stables charge more for this than we do. It's a ridiculous system. And then he had it on a credit system, so that if a horse was worked and ridden by a client, not one of us, not a student, but a client, the horse was credited 5 shillings, and that was subtracted from the account at the end of the month. The number of times he was used each time was 5 shillings off. And one of the client's horse was, he was an old client, and they had never raised his rate because he was an old client. They had let his rate stay, the amount he was paying stay the same, though they'd raised it for all the others, everybody else. There were 2 people like that, Miss Bryan and Philip Barker. And that was one reason Judy couldn't stand Philip Barker. For one thing, he wasn't having to pay the full price. That was enough right there. And he wasn't as nice as Miss Bryan was. Miss Bryan would let Judy hunt her horse and things like that. And Philip would come in and brag. The worst thing you could do in front of Judy, he'd come in and brag about how his horse had actually paid him money during the summer, because it had been used so much that its credit had amounted to more than the bill. And she had paid for herself during the summer. He hadn't had to pay a penny. And that would, Judy climbed the walls. She would come into the club room and she would fuss. She'd say, Philip Barker, his horse is going to pay her way for us this summer, and she'd make sure that the horse wasn't used. She'd change the books. She'd do everything. And she did great. One of her great accomplishments was after, at the end of the summer, she came in and told us that. She said, I handed him his bill, and he opened it, and he looked at it, and his face dropped, and he said, what? You mean I'm going to have to pay you? And Judy was just sort of indignation in her voice when she was telling it. Said, and the doggone thing was only for 5 shillings. It was the most she'd been able to work it up to. With all her dealings was 5 shillings. Philip was angry because he had to pay a bill. Judy was angry because he didn't have to pay 50 pounds. Everybody was upset. So she kept after her father at meal times. We'd go into, Dad, what's the rate on horses of boarding? And he'd tell her. It's in the brochure. All right, well, what's the rate for half-hour lessons? Well, there aren't any half-hour lessons except for children, and that's in the brochure. And she said, but we can't make some of these adults work ride for a whole hour. They just aren't up to it. And her father would say, well, they have to pay the rate for the whole hour. And that was funny because she couldn't compromise. She was having trouble there. She wanted that money, but she didn't want to make them ride a whole hour if they were too tired. So she finally got him to set up a whole new list of prices to go into effect after they left. And they dropped the credit system so that no horse would be able to just earn its way completely. they would always have some money coming in and just rearranged everything. But if she hadn't been in there pushing, it never would have been done.
Barbara, I like that little short glimpse you give us of Judy at the eel house while she's working on the barges on the canal. I just love to see some more of that. They had their evenings off, and that's where they like to go. And just solid talk, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know. Now, the times I went to her was to the local pubs. Of course, it was with a completely different crowd. It was talk, but it was a lot of a chatter. Not many good tales told, because there were too many people and everybody talking at once, and and the noise of everybody else in the pub. She was with a different crowd. She was with a bunch of cricket players and sports car people. And it makes a lot of difference in England, what people you're with. It's unbelievable, really.
Well, were you just with horse people all the time?
No, I was with the cricket players and the sports car people some of the time. And I was with the down and out punks some of the time. But I couldn't ever get in contact with anybody from around the universities, because there wasn't any sort of that sort of life in Stratford. Except one boy I met, and he was Canadian, was working working on his doctorate, doing research at Birmingham Extension. And other than that, there were just those three groups that I really got into: horse people, the cricket set.
What are they like?
Well, these boys had sports cars, and they played cricket on weekends. And most of the time, they were talking about the last party, last get-together, and how much they drank, and whose car was the fastest, and who drove the stupidest and the craziest. And they would sort of just that way. Stuart was the craziest driver on the road. And none of them were proud of Stuart. They just said it that way. He was stupid. They admitted it. They told him so to his face. Never made much impression on Stuart. And they were all great big fellas with broad shoulders and husky voices and sort of rough way with the girls that they went around with. Not courteous. I mean, you know, the thing where they'd ask you if you minded before they told a dirty joke, and then they go ahead and tell it anyway. But they'd ask you first. I went to a party, one of the parties, and particular party I happened to go to with them was a flop, because there were golf people there. And the golf people didn't mix with the cricket people. And so there were about three or four people that were cricket people, and they went around and danced and sat around and talked a little bit with each other. And the golf people stayed with each other, and everybody was golf people except for about three or four couples. So that was a flat failure and a half. And it had no life to it. Everybody just sat around in couples and talked a little bit, and mainly just said nothing or went in and danced. No conversation at all. And it was not their idea of a good party. Their idea of a good party was much more of a rousing affair. And it was with their own group, and they stayed with their own group. And they had a circle of about 5 or 6 pubs. And the center was the bell, or the boot. And those pubs were within a 30 to 60 mile radius, and they would visit 3 or 4 of them in an evening. And there would be somebody from their group at every one of those pubs, and they'd all end up back at the boot. And just about every Friday, certain pubs they'd only visit on certain days. Because for instance, if you didn't go to the Bell on Saturdays, because all the locals were in there on Saturdays, and it wasn't any good. And you didn't go to, always the boot was the place to go. That was their headquarters. But then to think of someplace different to go, they'd run through all their list of pubs that they'd go to, and they could figure on meeting somebody from their group at just about any one of those pubs. And as near as I could figure, they didn't talk to anybody else in the pub. If there wasn't somebody from their group there, then they just talked with their dates, but they wouldn't talk to anybody else in the pub. As nearly as I could figure out. I didn't go with them around the pubs because that was strictly dates. And I wasn't going out with one of them.
How did Nick's little statement sound to you? All you need to know is somebody like Jim, he knows everybody, and he'll take you around, and then you'll know everybody.
Judy made it work.
Yeah.
Now, Judy hadn't started out. See, she'd known Stuart. She got into this crowd because she knew Stuart. And she had to go to a party with one of her girlfriends, and she was dreading the whole thing. And she went to this party and started up a conversation with the Stuart, who she'd known years before because he used to take riding lessons out at the Tilks, very briefly. And it was a sort of old acquaintance conversation. But Judy has a good bit of sparkle, and Stuart was having a fight with his fiance, though he neglected to tell Judy this. So the next day he called her and started taking her out. His fiance packed off back to university. And he started taking Judy out every night. And one, two nights before Judy had found somebody that she wanted Trudy to go out with. And as soon as she had that worked out, to listen to the two of them talk, they knew everybody. Everybody that came in that pub. And they'd only been going out with them for about a week. But Trudy and Judy would get in a corner and they would watch everybody that came into a building. And if they were somebody that didn't belong there or who was new, they knew it, even though they'd only been in the place 3 or 4 times. And they would find out who the new person was, pester David or Stuart or somebody to tell them who it was and introduce them. And then they'd find out everything about them, whole private history, personal history, everything. They'd find out who the old girlfriends were and go plague them. By the time 2 weeks were over, they were discussing complete histories of some of the romances because this is what they were interested in. But it took them no time at all to find it out. And by the time 3 weeks were over, couldn't have been anybody come into the boot that they couldn't have spotted as either friend, foe, or stranger to the people that they were with. And all they needed, you see, was Stuart. One Stuart took Judy one time. And Judy's lively, and she doesn't mind the dirty jokes, and she thinks it's rather fun. And she didn't mind the them being boys. And the fast driving. And she'd tell them to slow down and all this sort of thing, but it was teasing more than anything else. She'd go along with them. And so she was really popular in that group. But none of them had the courage to tell her that Stuart was engaged. And she found it out all of a sudden. And the minute she found it out, there were two of them there ready to ask her to go out with them. So it didn't take her long to recover, and she stayed right in that group. And she's decided she likes Stuart's fiance. She thinks she's a nice girl. And she too took a lot of doing for her to make her keep herself from disliking her. But she figured that she couldn't and go out and keep going with this group, because they weren't going to split up just because she didn't like one of the boys.
Mm-hmm.
Girls, because it was the boys that hung together, and the dates were on the, you know, outside. She got thoroughly in with this group, and dropped all her old acquaintances.
Oh.
Just dropped them. She decided they were dull. I could have told her that before, but she didn't ask me.
Now, how did you find out about this?
Well, she and Trudy would talk constantly. I mean, they spent their whole time when they were, one period, about a couple of months. Every time they were together, they were talking about telling who they had seen and what sort of dress she was looking in, and didn't she look horrible or didn't she look pretty? Just constant.
At lunch?
Not so much at lunch. Lunch conversation was in front of her mother, and she couldn't talk like that in front of her mother. They couldn't have told, you know, gotten into it. But
it was after supper.
Well, it was during working hours.
Oh.
A little break. Well, tea time mostly.
Oh, tea time.
Tea time, because she didn't have supper with us. She disappeared up to the house. We very rarely saw her after that.
Oh. How long did you have for tea time?
Anywhere from 4:30 to 5:00 till 6:30.
Hmm?
Anywhere from, it depended on how much work we had.
Mm-hmm.
But anywhere, if you could work it right, you could get off at 4:30 and not have to go out again until 6:30. If you worked it wrong, you didn't get any tea time at all. That happened to me once or twice. I managed to, I didn't book them in, but I had lessons at 4:30 and 5:30. So I didn't get any tea, and then I had to get horses ready for 6:30 lessons, and I just had to work straight on through. And there's nothing that makes you mad, or more furious, or hungrier, or want a cup of tea more than that.
Well, now, this little ceremonious tea that you drink here, is that just a carryover?
Which little ceremonious tea?
Pouring hot water with instant tea.
Pouring hot water with instant tea. No, I've always had drunk tea at supper. I didn't used to drink coffee at all until I was forced to, remember.
And you didn't like milk.
And I didn't like milk.
That's another side of Judy Barber, but the glimpse that I have of her, you know, you just had a glimpse yourself, apparently, with the canal people.
That's right. I only had a glimpse.
At the pub, so
yeah.
Well, they went. And just, how do you say that?
Well, from what she said, I gathered that, for one thing, it was all canal people, barge people.
And older,
yeah. And what I gathered, I could just see this young 16, 17-year-old sitting there with her half pint of ale, because she said she drank beer when she was there, and really feeling that she was roughing it.
Oh.
And really feeling that she was out in the wide world.
And seeing life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And listening to the strong language and the terms and knowing the terms of the canal and knowing the language of the canal and really just laughing it up.
Yeah. That's right.
I see how that'd be. I just that glimpse of the. In, because you see, she could have gone up and down the canal several years with those people she was with and never seen it that way. Because they were they were great people. But if she just stayed with them,
uh-huh.
she might never have seen anything.
Mm-hmm.
She might have learned some things, but not the same way, not experienced.
But this way, she went to where they were all gathered in the evening and talking.
Yeah.
And she was too young to talk, and she didn't know anything anyhow to talk about. So she listened.
Well, that's what I got. I'm not, knowing Judy, I'm not sure it's true, but it's a nice picture. And she'd say we talked. But the way she talked about it,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The sort of way she talked about it,
was what she had picked up from listening.
Well, see, when I heard most of the talk about the canal, that was when she was just back.
Oh.
Or had been back only a few months, and it was all still sort of fresh. And the thought of being off on her own like that was still sort of fresh. And there's a good deal of pride in it. Of excitement of it. And there was no worry at all when she said that they called me Barge Woman Till. That'd been an honor, you see.
Oh, yeah.
She'd been Barge Woman Till.
Yeah.
Now, later on, she may worry about that some.
Yeah.
I guess there's some people that wouldn't take to being called Barge Woman.
Now, that was after she quit school.
Yeah, that was right after she quit school. She didn't waste any time. Summer after or something like that. And so when she first talked about it, it sounded awful big. And then later on you found out it was just a summer job for about 10 weeks. And it began to look smaller in her eyes, because it was her talking about it. And from what had been something really exciting and where she'd been something big, it reduced itself to a summer job where she'd worked for some people waiting on people.
Mr. Tilt just won't come through. You see, the what is
always easier to talk about.
Well, he was classy, man.
know. Think about it. Judy talked all the time. And I was with her all the time. And so it's not very hard to just find things that Judy said. Mr. Tilt very rarely talked. He would sit at the dinner table and not say a word the whole time. Or very little. Because he couldn't hear the conversation. And when he could hear, there were days when he could hear better than other days. It was the sort of thing where atmosphere, the pressure and everything would make a difference. And sometimes he would really come out. And he could hear the conversation. And he would be able to follow it, and it'd lead him into something. But most of the time, he couldn't hear well enough to get into it. And he'd just sort of sit down and his end of the table. And if somebody asked him something, he could pick it up, that was all right. And Mrs. Tilk would aim things down the table at him to try and get him into the conversation. But it was better when we rearranged things so that Judy sat beside him, because Judy would talk to him. But most of the time, he didn't talk that much. In lessons was the most sustained, longest talking I heard from him. And some of the stories he told at lunch, most of them I've already mentioned. But if you started, and a couple of times when they were talking about their holidays, but Mrs. Tilk talked most of the time about that, and he'd get in a comment every once in a while. And the only other time that I can remember that comes right off, but that I can remember him talking all that much, was when I went with him one time to judge a dressage competition. I was being his rider. And the whole time I was with him, just me. We didn't say more than boo to each other. You got that sheet of paper? Yeah, I've got that sheet of paper. And then he'd give me the comments on the writing, but he didn't go into them very much. And I'm too tongue-tied to draw anybody out on him. I don't know how to do it. I just sat there. But when we went back to the clubhouse, the fellow that ran the little riding club that was holding this competition wanted to know about Stoneleigh. So Mr. Tilt talked for a good almost hour, 45 minutes, about Stoneleigh and the problems he'd run into when it was being built. And unless you're interested in building a riding school, it was a bit dry. Well, he was talking about the things that you have to consider. Now, this fellow wanted to know about the materials that he'd been built with. And he said that you have to consider things like the roofing. Because if you get the wrong kind of roofing, even in England, it can get hot. It'll get hot and stuffy in the building. So you've got to find the right sort of roofing, and you've got to have the right kind of ventilation. And at Stoneleigh, they had put in experimental roofing. And the company, he had questioned it, and they swore to him that and he gave the figures on the amount of heat that was absorbed by the roofing that would be reflected down into the building. In other words, how much hotter it would be in the building than it would be outside. And they said that the ratio was much the same as it was for asbestos roofing, which is what almost everybody uses in England. And that's what his school has. So they put it in. Because he some things he had to sort of accept. He went around getting people to give materials for this place, and they would advertise. They had the right to advertise. You see. For instance, all the windows and all the mirrors were donated by Pilkington Glass. Well, the fact that Mr. Pilkington was a client might have had little to do with it, but also they were able to advertise that Pilkington Glass supplied the mirrors. And it becomes very complex. If you put the mirrors in the wrong place, then a rider riding on the side that the mirrors are on may be able to see himself all right. But if he's riding on the other side of the arena, he can't look across and see himself. So you want to put the mirrors so that he can at an angle so that they will reflect not only when he's riding on one side, but also when he's riding on the other side of the arena. And the kickboards. He couldn't find the wood for the kickboards. And finally he managed to find some place that would supply him with the wood, old seasoned timber. The kickboards are the slatting boards that go around the edges of the school. And he had them over at Windmill Hill and cut them up the right size and everything. But his big problem was with the roofing, which these contractors had sworn up and down was not going to overheat the place, because it did. The first summer they found it out. And besides that, the windows that had been put in were not the kind he'd wanted. And so he said that they had to, he was snorting and muttering, because what they'd done, instead of putting in the kind of windows they should have had, they had added, below the original windows, another row of windows for ventilation. And those were not only a different, they were tinted, a weird, odd tint that shouldn't have been in there. And they didn't do the job. And he was snorting because everything was, it was shoddy, you know, wasn't what he'd wanted. And what was it? Oh, he had to compromise that when he designed it, the school was the size of he wanted it to be big enough for international dress size competitions. And that means if it's going to be indoors, it's got to be the size of the arena plus so many feet on each side plus 50 feet distance on, added to the length, so that the judge can sit the proper length from the school. And see, all this is set down by the federal FEI, the international rule body. And he couldn't do it, because if he did it, the school would be so big that it would be exorbitantly expensive. So he had to narrow it a bit and shorten it a bit. And you can still almost get it in, but it's not quite big enough. Then he insisted that the school have showcases. This was his big triumph, one of the things that he had pushed and had gotten, was that outside, around the walls, there should be showcases. And that you can sell the space for advertising for equestrian products, saddlery, tack, veterinary products, so forth. And the committee on building the school said, no, it'll cost too much, it'll cost more to put that in. And we don't want to spend the extra money on it. But he convinced them to put it in, spend the extra money. He did a little wheeling and dealing so that they were practically in before the committee met. And within the first year, over 2/3 of the earnings of the school were from those showcases rather than from the instruction today and renting of the arena. So that the things that they did, what they didn't want to put in was because it was going to cost them a little more, was what was ended up paying most. I think he said that the money from the showcases paid the maintenance expenses for the school, covered the maintenance costs of the school, which is a pretty hefty item. The biggest part of it. And then he said that he'd run into, one of the problems he'd run into was when you design a school, he was talking about to this fellow was talking about designing schools, and he says, well, you be careful, because when they measure things, you've got to get somebody who knows about building a riding school and what it means. Because there was a woman up in Scotland who had a school built, and they measured, she said she wanted it so many feet high, the rafters so many feet high, and they built it with the rafters so many feet high, and then they put in the flooring and built it up with peat, and by the time they got through, her horses were practically hitting the rafters because she'd been low anyway. They'd been low anyway. And what had happened was that they had not figured in the height of the floor, the finished floor filled in and everything, when they had been figuring the height of the rafters from the ground. They had figured it from the ground and not from the floor level. And another thing he said that you have to worry about, especially up north, was the amount of light that you allowed in the school and the sort of roofing you used and what sort of skylights you were going to use. And he had it all worked out about how much light you should allow. And he had, in some instance, somebody had built a riding school and she had thought about it. And she had mentioned it to the contractors, and they had told her that the lighting they were putting in would, the amount of windows and everything, would have the school lighted, keep the school lighted on a sunny day. What they neglected to take into account was that her riding school was surrounded by pine trees, which cut off some of the sunlight. And she can't ride in that school without artificial light. And a cloudy day makes it, like, you know, really dark. And I was fascinated by that whole conversation. But it was pretty dry stuff, really. I mean, you know, you start telling somebody who doesn't care about building a riding school about it, and it doesn't come over very well. I thought it was pretty interesting. What amazed me about it was so many things that I never would have thought about. Like, this is, of course, I'd never built anything either. Everything, but he had all this right at his fingertips, because after all, he'd been working on this thing for 4 or 5 years. But
what was his interest in the stone?
He wanted to have, for one thing, there are 3 rule-making bodies in England for horses. There's the British Horse Society, there's the British Show Jumping Association, and there's the international rules, which apply to all countries. And the British Horse Society and the British Show Jumping Association are 2 great big huge bureaucracies, constantly at each other's throats and constantly jealous of each other, of their membership and so forth. So he wanted to have a place that was neutral ground. And Stoneley is neutral ground. It's both, it belongs both to the, it has offices, there are offices there for both societies. And the school itself is under the patronage of both societies. And it's supposed to be also a school for training, for where advanced courses can be offered by really international people. They've had Dinimothy from this country already. You know, they've had Dinimothy from this country. They've had for show jumping. Our team is supposed to be the best in the world for show jumping. They've had several people in dressage. And they offer courses, you see, and you can enroll in the course for so much, and it's sort of like a master class under a musician. And then also they hope someday to have students there, much like Windmill Hill has students, or a lot of the schools have students, residential, with buildings on the at the school for them to stay at. And it's a center for all sorts of events and training. And supposed to, what he hoped it'll do, I think, is to provide them with a national school, a national standard of riding. Something that you can say, well, look at somebody riding and say, well, they're not up to standard, and somebody will know what you mean. Instead of just sort of being a little bit vague about it, whose standard. And he devoted his through about 5 years to its development and its building it, running around to the contractors and so forth. And then they offered him the directorship of it. And he said no. He couldn't stand the fighting. But he knew, even before it had started, was gonna come. And he just sort of sits back and looks at his creation that he's got over there and the constant squabbling that's already part of it. And he just sits back and smiles.
And that's just across the pasture from
it? Well, no, it's good. It's about 10 or 15 miles from Windmill Hill. Close enough. He spends a lot of time over there.
Get that milk before night.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or after.
We'll go after 10.
I'll talk with you.
Only in the oh heck, I can't remember her name.
Elaine?
No.
I know who you mean.
The fact that her husband runs off and leaves her, it gives Soames an opening to reconsider divorce. And somehow they had to get between from old Julian's death to Soames. That's a jump of about 10 or 12 years.
Yeah. You know what they could have done now, if they were writing it now, they could have just skipped it.
Yeah.
Said so.
They have felt they had to have a little smoother transition.
Yes, that's right. The fiction of it, the art of it is a tremendous change.
Well, I think he's older. I think it occurred to me when I was watching it that the Shropshire Lad has always been there and always, well, I don't know whether he always will be or not, but certainly always has been. Whereas, like she said, this is, that was a period, the two periods, for instance, between the 1920s and the early ones are tremendously different, and the characters could only exist in one or the other. That Elaine couldn't have existed. It's the same character in the other period. Whereas the Shropshire Lad is always has been. I don't know whether you can still consider it so or not, but he always has been sort of eternal.
Well, all we're doing now is just sort of swapping the abstractions, which really don't apply. Well, the terms in which he thinks don't appeal to me at all. They're not any of my categories in this, not one.
Is there any in
Somers? Soames, even Soames, as he's represented here, is not a man of property. He just sort of flits from one little scene to another. The assumption is that he's a man of property, but you don't see him as a man of property.
Mm.
You don't see him as a lawyer. One of the things I had to learn was what I didn't understand. It took me a long time to know when I didn't understand anything. And when it didn't, when I didn't make contact, I would keep up contacts that I hadn't made. I did that all through literature. I've been much better, you know, if I had just slept them off.